From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn what Milwaukee area colleges and universities are doing to address COVID-19. Then, should citizenship matter in this public health crisis?
Americans in Europe are just as likely to be bringing the virus to the United States as are non-Americans. So to restrict one category of citizens, but to allow another, seems to be really missing the point. We're all equal opportunity disease vectors.
And on its 10th anniversary, we discuss the impact of the Affordable Care Act, both good and not so good.
If you have benefits that are great if only people knew about them, well, to what extent are you really expecting that voters are going to be able to make sense of all of these things that are wrapped in this big, complicated package?
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The novel coronavirus is officially considered a pandemic by the World Health Organization. In Wisconsin, there have been 8 confirmed cases of the virus, although none of them have been in Milwaukee. One person has recovered from the disease, but health officials are preparing for things to get worse. Governor Tony Evers declared a health emergency on Thursday so the state can access resources to respond to an outbreak. And colleges across the state are taking unprecedented action to limit large gatherings and keep people safe. Many schools are extending spring breaks, moving classes online, and canceling events and travel. UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee announced their decisions to suspend in-person classes on Wednesday, along with most other UW campuses. Several private colleges and universities, including Marquette, MSOE, El Verno, Concordia, and Cardinal Stritch, are also turning to remote instruction. WUWM education reporter Emily Files joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in studio to tell us more about the dramatic steps colleges are taking in response to COVID-19.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me how things have evolved in the last week when it comes to Wisconsin University's reaction to the coronavirus.
When this week started, there were no colleges or universities in Wisconsin that were halting in-person instruction. What colleges had done at that point was cancel study abroad programs and bring students home, especially from places that have large coronavirus outbreaks like Italy. But there were some major universities in other states canceling face-to-face instruction like Harvard, Columbia, and Ohio State. Then, this week on Wednesday, it was like watching dominoes fall. UW-Madison announced that it was suspending in-person instruction. And after that, one after another, more universities made similar decisions to suspend in-person classes.
Right. They just keep on coming. So why did UW-Madison decide to cancel in-person classes, and why now?
The coronavirus is becoming a more imminent threat in the U.S., and for universities here, the timing right now is really key because a lot of them have spring break coming up next week. So they're thinking students are going to be going back home, maybe to states where there are a large number of COVID-19 infections, and then they're coming back to campus. Is that safe? So Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank said at a press conference Wednesday that they're asking students to leave for spring break and not come back if they don't have to.
It has become clear that now is the time for the university to take broader action. Earlier today, I announced that we were suspending face-to-face instruction starting March 23rd, when students would typically return to classes following spring break. This will be in place until at least April 10th, and we will reevaluate this decision in early April.
So they're asking students to not come back to campus, but what about international students or other students who don't have a permanent home that's easy to get back to, that they stay on campus year-round, even during these breaks?
UW-Madison and other universities are saying that accommodations will be made for students who need to stay in university housing.
So which other colleges have followed UW-Madison's lead and suspended in-person classes?
A lot of them. Almost all of the UW campuses have taken that step. Some of them, including UW-Milwaukee, are also extending their spring break by an extra week to give instructors more time to adapt their classes for remote delivery. MATC just announced Thursday evening that they're suspending classes all of next week to prepare for a switch to online delivery. So locally, there's UWM, Marquette, MSO, Alverno, Concordia, MIAD, Carthage, Cardinal Stritch, all of those schools have taken similar steps. But this is a rapidly changing situation, and there are probably other schools that will join that list. And also, a lot of the colleges are hoping to return to normal in-person instruction mid-April, but that decision will be made depending on the coronavirus situation.
Right. Nothing is quite for sure yet. So how are students and professors reacting to this news? I'm sure it will be a lot of work to move classes that were meant to be taught face-to-face into an online mode.
Yeah, it's just going to be an unprecedented challenge for teachers and students. I was on UWM's campus on Tuesday before an official announcement about moving classes online had happened, but there was discussion happening about it. So I talked to some department leaders about what this would look like for them to move almost all online in whatever way they can. And Kaushal Chari is the dean of the Lubar School of Business. He told me his thoughts.
And online is not that easy. It takes a lot of training, a lot of preparation, a lot of planning to do a good job. And so getting everyone on board with the adequate training in a short period of time is not going to be easy.
And I also talked to Suzanne Boyd. She's the chair of the UWM Mathematics Department. She said the more than 100 math instructors are going to need a lot of support to move classes online.
What I want is people to come to my department, like tomorrow, and start offering training sessions in computer labs. I'm not even sure how many of our faculty members have a laptop with a webcam in it, so it may not be easy for them to just pop open their webcam and, you know, record a lecture. They may not have a chalkboard at home on which to write.
So UWM administrators heard these concerns from faculty, and that's one major reason they're extending the spring break by an extra week to provide more time, but it's still going to be a major challenge.
So what about the students? What are they saying?
I talked to UWM pre-med student Angelique Kramer on Tuesday morning before an official decision had been made, and she was pretty skeptical about whether she would be able to get the same level of education through online classes.
For a lot of people, I know I'm one of them, I hate online classes. It doesn't work for me. It's easy for me to get wrapped up in doing other things, like going to work, picking up more shifts, and doing this and that, because you don't feel like you have the need to go to class because you're not there, and especially, and that's going to happen if the classes are closed.
There are also questions about students who don't have laptops at home or who don't have reliable internet access, but universities are trying to figure out how to help those students.
Right. So what about all the classes, you know, I'm thinking like performing arts or science classes with labs? How can those be transferred online? Most of those require you to have hours in those settings.
Yeah, the answer from a lot of universities and colleges is that we're still figuring those questions out. There are some classes that just might not work with online delivery. UW-Madison says that research labs will continue to operate and students working in those labs will continue with their work there. I talked to Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design President Jeff Morin on Thursday. MIAD made the decision to extend spring break by a week and move instruction online as much as possible. But it's an art and design school, and Morin said it's going to be difficult for the classes that require hands-on learning.
There are some areas that are going to be particularly challenging. So when it comes to direct observational drawing, for instance, figure drawing of a model where everyone is working in the same room from the same subject matter, we're going to have to rethink how to get students up to speed with particular skills while not having that direct experience for the next few weeks.
MIAD is going to keep studio labs where students do things like photo production and screen printing open, at least for now, but the school will not be holding in-person instruction in those spaces.
So we have a situation where there are all these colleges canceling face-to-face classes kind of on an unprecedented level. But what about all the younger students, the K-12 schools? Why haven't those school districts been making similar announcements this week?
K-12 districts like Milwaukee Public Schools have different considerations. It's a more difficult call to make in some ways. Many of the students rely on the meals that they get in school. Many families can't afford to stay home with students if school is canceled, whereas college students are more independent and can take care of themselves for the most part. So, and also online delivery of college classes is maybe easier than K-12 schools because colleges are used to offering at least some classes online. So it's definitely something that we're starting to see in other states. K-12 districts have closed in Washington and New York. Ohio announced on Thursday that schools would close there, but Wisconsin hasn't taken that step yet.
Well, and we'll certainly fill in our listeners as we learn more. Emily, thanks for filling us in on how schools are responding to the coronavirus.
Thank you.
Well, and we'll certainly fill in our listeners as we learn more. Emily, thanks for filling us in on how schools are responding to the coronavirus.
Thank you.
Emily Files is WUWM's education reporter, and she joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the steps colleges are taking in response to the coronavirus. You can find all of our related coverage at wuwm.com/coronavirus. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. We're continuing the conversation about the new coronavirus with a look at the effectiveness of certain policies. On Wednesday night, President Trump delivered a rare Oval Office address. Here is some of what he had to say.
The European Union failed to take the same precautions and restrict travel from China and other hotspots. As a result, a large number of new clusters in the United States were seeded by travelers from Europe. After consulting with our top government health professionals, I have decided to take several strong but necessary actions to protect the health and well-being of all Americans. To keep new cases from entering our shores, we will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days.
The president also said that restrictions wouldn't apply to the United Kingdom and some traveling Americans. The administration later clarified that U.S. citizens are still allowed to travel and the restrictions also don't apply to Ireland or Eastern Europe. Lake Effect's Julian Haida recently spoke with UW-Madison's Richard Keller, a historian of medicine and bioethics. They start by discussing the effectiveness of travel bans to slow viruses.
Travel restrictions, as they've been imposed, are really quite ineffective at halting the spread of the virus. For one thing, Americans in Europe are just as likely to be bringing the virus into the United States as are non-Americans. So to restrict one category of citizens but to allow another seems to be really missing the point. We're all equal opportunity disease vectors. At the same time, I would argue that travel warnings as opposed to travel restrictions can be highly effective tools. Travel warnings, for example, CDC issued a level 3 travel warning for most of the Schengen zone in Europe on Wednesday night this week. And that travel warning, had it gone into effect a week ago, could have been a really effective tool. Because what travel warnings do is they offer people a relatively objective criterion for their own decision making. They let us know, okay, this is a place where I might really want to reconsider travel. I really might want to postpone travel. A travel restriction, however, has a much more draconian feel to it, and it has the tendency to inspire fear and indeed has the capacity to spur people to flight, which is actually the last thing you want to do in one of these situations. So it can be really quite counterproductive.
Right. I mean, the president said that people only had a couple of days until midnight Friday. I mean, really 48 hours or so to get out of Europe.
That's correct. And anecdotally, I've heard a number of stories of, I don't want to say price gouging, but let's say surge pricing on tickets. You had a number of Americans as well as non-Americans who heard this story last night. They heard reports about the president's speech and fled immediately to Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam or to Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris and bought tickets immediately to come home. And this, of course, led to a rapid sort of exponential increases in the prices of tickets. And really, they were acting on incomplete information.
It wasn't clear at first. The president said, restricting travel, and only later came out and said to U.S. citizens.
That's exactly right. And so the carve-outs for American citizens, that news took hours to reach many people. And at that point, it was already too late. And you have people who are spending thousands of dollars to get a plane ticket to come home tomorrow, essentially. And, they're in a really desperate situation because of misinformation.
And because they're doing so quickly, I read one of the issues with travel bans and kind of the way that people rush out of a country or back into a country, there really isn't a way of ensuring, because they feel like, the door is closing, that they don't have, the virus in them.
Absolutely, because of this kind of frenzied travel, and indeed this is also going to spur, of course, clandestine travel, then it makes proper screening much more difficult to accomplish.
It's very interesting you mentioned clandestine travel. I think, a lot of people praise China for the way that they controlled this virus at first. Some people are critical of the fact that it took them a few weeks to really acknowledge that the virus really existed. But China did restrict domestically travel to around 56 million people. And I've read reports in Politico that as many as 5 million people left Wuhan and cities that are in lockdown.
This is something I haven't heard personally, but I find it entirely believable.
Earlier, you mentioned the Schengen zone, the fact that U.S. citizens, aren't necessarily immune in any sort of unique way. I mean, a passport isn't a vaccine. And what really stood out to me when I was listening to the president speak the other night was the fact that the United Kingdom is exempt from these travel restrictions. To kind of my ears, that really stood out in the sense that President Trump has been very close with a lot of the people who've been arguing for Brexit. He, in the same breath, criticized the European Union's response to the coronavirus. Did that stick out to you in the same way that it did to me?
It does. It doesn't seem as if there's any real epidemiological justification for the UK carve-out. It strikes me as one could come up with any number of rationales for it, but none of them really seem to make very good sense from a public health perspective.
Yeah, I was reading that Boris Johnson came out and said that as many as 10,000 Brits have COVID-19. So, it kind of signals to the fact that the epidemiological justification isn't necessarily there, and yet this is still a policy that a lot of people are advocating for and leaning on. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that travel bans and restrictions seem so powerful and politically viable?
I think people see them as decisive action. But again, I would argue that in many ways they inspire a kind of misplaced confidence. Borders are notoriously leaky, and the idea that imposing this kind of a travel restriction is going to halt the entry of the virus into the country is, I think, pretty misguided. At the same time, of course, we already have any number of cases already in the country. If the virus has reached pandemic proportions, according to the World Health Organization, that means it's not just going to be Chinese and European citizens who are going to be spreading the disease. In order to reach pandemic proportions, a disease has to be spread unilaterally. And so what we're already seeing many instances of community spread within the United States.
Sure. And I mean, it seems like at this point, you're more likely to encounter, an Italian and contract the virus as opposed to someone who with, Asian-looking features. And yet there have been a lot of cases since the very beginning of the coronavirus of racial profiling.
Absolutely. The xenophobia associated with the coronavirus pandemic has been You know, I'd like to say astonishing. Unfortunately, it has so many historical precedents that it's in some ways not surprising at all.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm talking with Richard Keller. He's a professor of medical history and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You are a historian of medical history and bioethics. I'm curious, what is the kind of historical precedent for this? Obviously, we know a lot medically in this day and age, and yet there's something very medieval about closing borders, it seems, to prevent the spread of a disease.
Yeah, you know, certainly I'm not a medieval historian. I study the history of public health in modern in modern Europe and the United States. So I don't know that I feel confident going back to the Black Death, but certainly there are important historical precedents here. It's important to recognize that disease does travel. Right, of course. And disease and transportation have been really closely associated for centuries, right, if not millennia. And so one can see the intuitive nature of a travel restriction, how this seems to be almost a sort of reflexive response of many states. If you look at historical precedents, though, it's at times the movement of people that spreads disease, but it's at times other forms of trade and global commerce that have spread disease. So I can give you a couple of historical antecedents. Bubonic plague seems to have been endemic in southern China around 1850 or so.
Same bubonic plague that we know of? I mean, speaking of offhandedly mentioning the medieval times.
That's exactly right. Yes, the same bacillus. You know, it still exists, of course, in much of the world today, in particular in the Southwest United States, where it's primarily affecting prairie dogs, among other rodents. So, in about 1850 or so in southern China, it's endemic, but it only reaches truly pandemic proportions when it hits Hong Kong in 1894. At that point, Hong Kong was, of course, a major hub of British colonial commerce. And within just a few years, the disease had reached virtually every port city in the world. It went from Hong Kong to Bombay in 1896, and by 1900, it had reached San Francisco, Buenos Aires, Cape Town, any number of major port cities around the world. Now, that wasn't so much a function of human travel, but a function of the movement of rats aboard ships. Ships, of course, have always been teeming with rats. Plague is a vector-borne disease that's carried by rat fleas. And so it's the fleas on those rats that were being transported around the world that were much more important in spreading the disease than were the people themselves. And yet, one of the main responses one saw to the outbreak of plague in San Francisco, for example, in 1900, was a quarantine of Chinatown. Now, this, again, was in many ways akin to the kind of travel restriction that we're seeing from the speech on Wednesday night. It was a quarantine that applied to ethnic Chinese, but allowed American business owners in and out of that quadrant of the city. So it was a particularly leaky quarantine. Now, it was ineffective, of course, because it allowed that much human traffic, but it was also particularly ineffective because the main vector of the disease was rats. And so controlling the movement of people doesn't really do anything to control the movement of the real vector in this case.
And I was reading a little bit about how in 1918, with the Spanish flu, the only places that really effectively managed to quarantine were places that the disease traveled on ships. So, I mean, does that hold up? I mean, ships travel much more slowly than airplanes or rats or even people sneaking by.
Yeah, it is important to think about the changes in our transportation networks. We're, of course, far more globally interconnected than we've ever been. And airplane, you know, flight route maps, of course, show this incredible web that spans the planet. While shipping networks in the 19th and early 20th centuries were, of course, quite extensive, they don't match anywhere near the kind of speed and simultaneity that we see at present with air travel.
And so, therefore, it requires a lot more care and attention.
Indeed. And in many ways, these kinds of travel restrictions are often, in this day and age, really a matter of closing the barn door after the horse has left.
Sure, so the disease spreads once it's already in a particular place.
Exactly.
knowing what you know as a historian of medicine, this is the wave the magic wand question. You know, as a historian and knowing how things have changed, what do you think people could do better, whether it's socially or with regards to public health?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to take a long view, if that's okay.
Of course.
Diseases like natural disasters, right? Epidemic diseases have the capacity to exploit the ecologies in which they find themselves. So let's think of disease as a seed and the environment in which disease spreads as a soil. If you have a robust seed but infertile soil, the disease simply won't spread. So merely the presence or absence of a virus in a given population doesn't make an epidemic. If you look at the example of a disease like cholera in 19th century Europe, for example, or indeed even in 21st century Haiti, where it arrived in the aftermath of the earthquake, it's a disease that can be present, but in sanitary circumstances, ordinary water filtration and good sanitation can prevent the disease from becoming epidemic. But when cholera reached 19th century European industrializing cities, which had no effective drainage, which didn't have sewage systems, which had no water filtration, which had no water treatment, they exploded in the population, killing thousands of people in days or weeks. We can see similar sorts of things happening with disease in the 20th century. HIV, AIDS, for example, exploited vulnerabilities in Western populations because of the sort of prevalence of unprotected sex or rampant injecting drug use. Those were conditions that were pretty prevalent in the 1970s in the United States, and it was only really the arrival of the virus that showed us just how vulnerable we were as a population through those kinds of risks. If we look at a disease like coronavirus, like COVID-19, we can see that it's exploiting a network of global travel, certainly, but it's going to have much more powerful effects in some societies than others. I would argue that some of the vulnerabilities that we see in the United States right now include things like the precariousness of labor for many Americans. Many Americans don't have much sick leave, if any at all. So they're far more likely to go to work when they're not feeling well in order to not miss out on the income from a shift.
And the rise of the gig economy also means there's no boss to give you that sick leave or to pay for, you know, you're paying for yourself.
That's exactly correct. So an Uber driver, for example, or a Lyft driver will be probably far more likely to pull a shift while not feeling particularly well because they don't have a backup and they don't have a sick leave. The same thing goes for many food service workers. So we have a population that's likelier to work when sick than a population that can rely on a social safety net in quite the same way as people who are perhaps a little bit more precariously employed in other countries. So this presents, I think, an enormous atmosphere of risk in the United States that's probably far more important to address than something like a travel restriction.
Sure. And it gets a little bit at the issue of prevention a little bit. Just this week, the CDC had to come out with advice for people to wash their hands because specifically that is the way to not overburden the medical system. So, of course, the advice to wash your hands has always existed, but I think a lot of people here in America take a lot of pride in the medical system and say, well, if I get sick because I didn't wash my hands once or twice, I can go to the hospital and I'll be fine in a few days. And yet the medical system, even under the best circumstances and even assuming a broad insured public, which isn't the case, it's certainly exposing issues in our medical system.
One of the critical issues that we need to think about is ancillary deaths or ancillary disability that's going to accompany a COVID pandemic. So, for example, if all of our intensive care beds are occupied by people who are suffering from a severe illness as a consequence of a COVID-19 infection, that means that those beds are not available for people who are suffering from severe flu infections. That means they're not available for people who are suffering from pneumonia. That means they're not available for people who are suffering from a broad range of other diseases who might otherwise need those beds.
And this is happening in China as well. Someone gets into a car crash while all the hospitals are really working overtime on something completely different, an infectious disease that doesn't necessarily have all the capacity for trauma care.
That's precisely the case. Exactly. And in Italy, we're seeing the triaging even of patients with COVID-19 because they're occupying virtually every bed in the country.
So prevention is very important.
Prevention is absolutely key in order to avoid overburdening the healthcare system. That's correct.
That was UW-Madison Professor Richard Keller talking with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. The Affordable Care Act is celebrating its 10th anniversary. The landmark legislation has had a huge impact on the way healthcare operates in the United States. More than 20 million people have health insurance as a result of the ACA, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Still, since it passed in 2010, the ACA has faced challenges that threaten its efficacy. Today, as the country grapples with a pandemic, there are questions about the kind of care this legislation guarantees and its limitations. Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and an expert on public policy. He recently wrote a paper examining the ACA for the journal Health Affairs. Rocco is here in the studio. Phil, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Hey, great to be here, Joy.
Before the ACA, what was insurance like in the United States?
Yeah, so before the Affordable Care Act, the number of people with health insurance had been slowly declining really since the 1970s. And one of the reasons this is that employers were facing higher and higher costs for medical care, right, as medical inflation went up. And at the same time, the number of people who were protected by labor unions was decreasing. And so gradually insurers like lost the incentive that they had to maintain that coverage. ERISA was a law which allowed some insurers to self-insure. So they pulled out of larger group plans, created their own plans. And so you started to see greater instability in these larger risk pools. And so over time, fewer and fewer people had insurance from their employers, which is really sort of was supposed to be the backbone for working age Americans, the way that the federal government sort of subsidized health insurance for employers beginning in the 1940s. It was really supposed to be the backbone, but by the 1990s, that had really began to crater. And so what many Americans without insurance, my grandparents, for example, who had a small business, had to buy plans on the very, very limited individual marketplace, because most people didn't buy the plans until they were sick. Premiums were sky high. These plans also had a number of restrictions on coverage for people with pre-existing conditions, including kids with like chickenpox, for example. In some cases, there are all kinds of horror stories you can go back and look at. And of course, Medicaid, which is now we think of as a program that covers about 1 in 5 Americans. Many low-income Americans receive health insurance through Medicaid. It was a plan that was much more restricted to select sort of populations, people with disabilities, low-income seniors who had needed help with 2 or more activities, daily living, things like that. The system was even more fragmented than it is presently.
So how did the Affordable Care Act respond, essentially, to a lot of these exclusions, a lot of the issues that we had with these health insurance plans before this piece of legislation was ultimately crafted?
So one way of thinking about it is for many years prior to the Affordable Care Act, in fact, most of the 1970s, 1980s, and early 1990s, the emphasis on what national health insurance should look like was a reform that made the system universal. Medicare for All, effectively, was on presidential platforms for Jimmy Carter. Even Richard Nixon supported this. But there was a real change in the political economy of health insurance, especially in the 1990s, insurers became a really powerful lobby against this sort of comprehensive reform. Pharmaceuticals as well had become a really sort of powerful and entrenched lobby to prevent that kind of systemic reform. And so in 2010, the strategy of the Obama administration and Democratic leaders in Congress was that rather than try to get through that gauntlet of interest group politics to actually bring in what had been historical opponents of comprehensive reform and actually make them into some of the authors of the legislation. So key provisions of the ACA were written by America's health insurance plans, written by pharma lobbyists, written by these sort of interests. Now, in the end, not all of these sectors signed on to the legislation. So, for example, the insurance industry started out as a partner, but ultimately bailed because the ACA had some provisions that restricted insurers from charging people more based on their age, the so-called community rating provisions. But the general strategy of the ACA was, rather than remaking the system, to try to fill in the gaps in coverage that people experience. So on the one hand, taking this individual marketplace, which had been incredibly limited and prohibitively costly, and providing subsidies to insurers and people who didn't qualify for Medicaid so that they could purchase insurance on the individual marketplace. On the other hand, take Medicaid and expand coverage to all individuals with incomes of up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which is in individual person terms about $17,000 per person today. And then to take some other steps to restructure the rules around what insurers had to cover, covering people with pre-existing conditions, adult children being able to be on their parents' insurance till the age of 26, a variety of sort of individual market reforms, and then thousands of pages of other provisions designed to, you know, sort of reform the way that care is delivered and paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. So in a way, it was an approach to reform that wasn't about systemic transformation, but about sort of plugging in some of the gaps in coverage.
What are some of the most notable gaps that have been filled as a result of the ACA?
So one way of thinking about this is that the ACA accounts for about 20 million more Americans receiving coverage. And some of those key gaps that have been filled, I think, are really at the lower end of the income distribution, people who qualify for Medicaid because they live at 138% of the federal poverty level or less. Of course, because of the Supreme Court's 2012 ruling in a case called NFIB versus Sebelius, states didn't have to expand Medicaid. States could opt in. So a lot of states chose not to opt in to Medicaid expansion, and about 14 states still have not opted in at one level or another. And so in many ways, that gap is filled, but it depends on where you live. The individual marketplace was supposed to be a sort of crucial gap-filling measure for people living above 138% of the federal poverty level, but still lower middle-income folks. But those plans remain quite expensive, depending on where you are. Insurers have had varying incentives to come in and stick around in the marketplace. And the premiums in those plans, as well as the cost sharing in those plans, can remain prohibitively costly for a lot of people. And so the ACA, you can think about it as vastly reducing the number of people without any coverage at all, but there are a number of people who remain underinsured, meaning they're spending a significant portion of their annual income on the care that they need, either through premiums or cost sharing.
You know, you mentioned 14 states have not expanded Medicaid. I believe we're in one of those states.
Yeah, that's right. Wisconsin has not expanded Medicaid. There was a move during the Walker administration to change Wisconsin's Medicaid waiver to expand coverage up to 100% of the federal poverty level within Badger Care. So it was sort of a punt, an attempt to do something else. But no, we haven't expanded Medicaid in Wisconsin.
For states that have expanded Medicaid, what has that ultimately meant for their coverage?
I mean, coverage has expanded pretty dramatically in states that expanded Medicaid. And I think this has impacts not just for individuals. Certainly does. Health outcomes have changed significantly. There's been a measurable decrease in mortality rates among a variety of populations within Medicaid and states that have expanded it. But also, it has had a huge effect on hospitals. So the amount of care that is uncompensated in hospitals has been drastically reduced in states that expanded Medicaid.
So it's ultimately been helpful for hospital systems.
You can think about it as something that has helped to sustain and even solidify the infrastructural capacity of hospitals, especially in rural areas.
I was about to say, that seems significant because we know there are a lot of rural hospitals that are having a lot of financial difficulties.
Yeah, and I think this is something that remains an issue for rural hospital systems. The limited population, the fact that it can be difficult to staff key departments in the hospital, these all contribute to real infrastructural challenges, even if it's something that's not causing the hospital to have real organizational or fiscal problems today, it's something that people are worried about. And so that is something that I think you can see the Medicaid expansion is having one sort of primary impact, not just on individuals' ability to get insurance, but like what we think of as the health infrastructure that we live in. And that infrastructure matters not only for the people who have Medicaid or Medicare or coverage financed through some part of the ACA, but people who just need to go to the hospital, right, if there's some kind of emergency.
So going back to some of the provisions inside of the ACA, you know, there are certain ones that I certainly didn't know about before they came into play in my life. We were just talking about this before the interview. I had to get a number of vaccinations recently, and I found out they were $0 because they were suggested by the CDC. What are some of these lesser-known provisions that have come out of the ACA that have a big impact?
Yeah, I think the essential health benefits is one of the big ones. It is, you know, the sort of protections for treatments, preventative treatments that are recommended by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, things like vaccine, right? Those are really important, but there's something that you don't recognize until you need it. $11 billion for community health centers, which in a city like Milwaukee provide a crucial, absolutely essential part of our health infrastructure here. Also, just the idea that primary care is something that there should be an essential health benefit, something that getting a preventative screening, a checkup, you know, your annual wellness visit, that should be something that you don't have to pay a significant amount of money for cost sharing or out-of-pocket expenses for. All of these sort of hidden benefits are something that make the ACA, you know, potentially like surprisingly good, but they're also something that I think creates a political risk for the law. If you think about Social Security, when it passed, people got a Social Security card, right? They knew quite simply that they would be eligible for a public pension at a certain point in time when they retired. Same thing with Medicare, right? When you reach a certain age, you just become eligible. These benefits are all fairly legible to the public. The ACA would have been difficult to describe in that way. In fact, you know, there's now this like body of experts and scholars that like make a living on translating the ACA for like a public audience. It's a patchwork of many, many different reforms. That means that in the earliest years of the law, it was very, very difficult for people to understand the ways in which it benefited them. And the law itself didn't make it easy to do. And so when you look at, for example, like public opinion on the ACA, it's divided really along partisan lines until there's a threat of repeal. And suddenly the benefits of the ACA become more visible because there's a possibility that they're going to be taken away. And patients, physicians, a number of other advocacy groups begin raising the legibility of these benefits, and suddenly they become clear. But this is sort of one lesson of policy reform, which is that if you have benefits that are great if only people knew about them, well, to what extent are you really expecting that voters are going to be able to make sense of all of these things that are wrapped in this big, complicated package? You know, are you really expecting reform to be politically sustainable if its core beneficiaries don't even know that they're beneficiaries?
Yeah. There's been a lot of confusion right now with coronavirus, with COVID-19, about what is covered by insurance, what should be covered by insurance, and what mechanisms we have inside of the ACA to deal with pandemics.
I mean, so there was an announcement by the Trump administration yesterday, I think, that said that the COVID-19 test would qualify as an essential health benefit under the ACA. But still, large employer health plans have to cover the benefit of preventative testing, but those tests don't have to be free, right? And if you think about it, one reason for this confusion and this lack of clarity is that the ACA didn't replace this very fragmented system of payers and providers that exists in the United States. That question, will you be able to get the test for free? Not a question in the United Kingdom that has a national health service, right? Not a question in Taiwan. Not a question in countries that sort of guarantee a certain minimum of health benefits as a sort of citizenship right. The fact that we still live in a pretty fragmented architecture for health coverage is one thing that contributes to this, because you have to go out looking for information. Am I going to be covered? Will this test be free? And that search for information from a sort of like consumer's perspective, although I like to think about people as patients, not consumers, it actually can inhibit people from maybe getting tested if they feel that that would be a good idea.
So this gets actually back to one of my big questions about the Affordable Care Act. What are the limitations of this piece of legislation?
I think the limitations of the Affordable Care Act are ironically related to what made it a political strength in, you know, 2010, which is it was designed to be a piece of legislation that would move through the institutional gauntlet of interest group politics, right? And the idea is don't rock the boat, fill in the gaps, deal with some of the worst exigencies created by the American healthcare system, and you will have a piece of legislation that will be a signature, landmark, historic piece of legislation. But sometimes what is good legislative politics doesn't make good health policy, right? And I think this is as true for Democrats in many ways who are trying to get a piece of legislation through the gauntlet as it is for Republicans who are sitting in state legislatures thinking about, am I going to be primaried if I vote for Medicaid expansion? And I think some of the biggest limitations of the ACA is that it really doesn't deal with some of the forces in the economy of healthcare that make healthcare persistently unaffordable for many people. It doesn't deal with the fact that prices are a significant driver of cost, and there's really no significant price control mechanisms within the Affordable Care Act. Those things are sort of left on the table. We don't allow Medicare, for example, to negotiate for drug prices, is one commonly heard refrain about some of these limitations. Another way of seeing it is that the Affordable Care Act doesn't tackle what are some of the most significant inequalities in the way that we allocate healthcare. And the kind of care that you receive depends not just on what age you are, where you fall in the income distribution, whether or not you qualify for various means-tested forms of care, but also, in some cases, who you work for, how stable that work is, and if you are covered in the individual marketplace, do you happen to live in a place where there is robust competition that drives down premiums, or do you live in a place where the risk pool is disproportionately made up of people who need a lot of care? And I find this as a scholar very difficult, because sometimes you get asked a very reasonable question: what's been the effect of the Affordable Care Act on coverage? And my answer has to be this very annoying, pointy-headed, scholarly answer, which is, well, that depends on, you know, where you live and what insurance market you're in. But that, to me, is an index of what some of the gaps and inadequacies left by the Affordable Care Act are.
Yeah. Well, Philip Rocco, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and an expert on public policy. He recently wrote a paper examining the 10-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act for the journal Health Affairs. We have time now for a song by fingerstyle guitarist Alexander Misko. The young Russian musician recently traveled to Milwaukee to perform in UWM's Peck School of the Arts MKE Unplugged series. We'll have the full interview with Misko in the coming weeks, but for now, please enjoy his original song, Thunderstorm. ¶¶ That's fingerstyle guitarist Alexander Misko performing his song Thunderstorm in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. We'll air the full interview with him in the coming weeks. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Julian Haida and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer, and we also heard from Emily Files from the WUWM News team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Matternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.